Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Hello,
and welcome to Moon Magic with Jeanette and David Ewing. This is the David here, and here's the Jeanette.
Hello, good evening. And tonight we are going to be continuing our springtime discussion, I think, talking about renewal and growth is a positive thing that we can talk about and focus on as a means to do a few things, help us to stay present and in the moment so that we remain connected to nature, help us to stay connected to doing some sort of positive activity while we are able to. Of course, not everyone is lucky enough to be able to have access to a yard or property to work with plants. But there are a number of ways you can work with plants. I mentioned gardening is one tool, is one method, and you can certainly introduce an element of sacred gardening or magical gardening into what you do. But also, even when you are not always able to get outdoors, it's worth noting that in places north of here, like in Wisconsin, probably the Chicagoland area, northern Illinois, Michigan, many parts of the Northeast, it's still pretty chilly. And spring might not be that evident, but there are still a number of ways you can connect with plants. And not just plants. We all see, and there are boatloads of books out there, websites galore on how to connect with your animal spirit guide or animal totem, but very little has been written about working with plant totems, certainly not fungus totems.
There's probably been more written about working with trees than any other plant, really.
True.
Yeah.
But also, there's only one other author I've seen that talks about working with plant spirit familiars or plant helpers. Selena Fox, on her shows, has also occasionally talked about it, but it's still not something that people talk about too terribly much. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring on this particular author who has written a number of books on a different way of looking at eco-shamanism, and also working with totems. And in this case, it is plant and fungus totems. So Lupa Greenwolf is a neo-shaman, artist, and sustainability geek who has been working with animal magic in various forms since the 1990s. She possesses a master's degree in counseling psychology and is the author of Fang and Fur, Blood and Bone, DIY Totemism, Skin Spirit, and New Paths to Animal Totems. So when she wrote this book, it was something I was immediately interested in because it is so very different. So let's go ahead and bring author Lupa Greenwolf on.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hello. How are you?
We are doing pretty well. We are quite busy. We are lucky that we, with the kind of work that we do, we have not had to worry about job loss. In fact, because of the need to now do teleworking and remote teaching on my part, we are fairly busy these days with having to incorporate new technologies.
Yeah.
Certainly I have at the community college, and David's had to do a lot of hand-holding.
Right, so I do tech support. I do user support for a law firm in D.C., and everybody's working from home right now, and about half of the people have never worked from home before, so it's been interesting for us.
Yeah, sounds like it's brought you some interesting new challenges.
It is.
Definitely. I happened to see the other day that you posted I have enviously followed your adventures in chicken farming. I think it's cool that you have them. And you'll occasionally post pictures of them. And you posted just the other day that you had a whole bunch of eggs and you had some left over. And the funny thing is that now eggs are super expensive.
Hard to get a hold of.
So keep your little baby chicken, your little girls happy, because it could end up being a bumper crop for you.
I actually already sell the extra eggs at a local market and to local customers. So yeah, it's definitely a little bit of a bonus right now.
Definitely, and the other thing I was looking at before the show started was growing calendars in different places. And I know that you live in Oregon. You've also posted a lot of pictures of your dog and going to the beach often enough that you obviously aren't that far from the coast either. I think you're in zone 8 or something like that. So what's the weather like at this time of year where you're at?
I mean, right now, our highs get up into the 50s, and then our lows are usually 40s, maybe down into the upper 30s. And, of course, we're getting a mix of rain and sun this time of year. We had about a week of sun, and now we're getting back into some rain, less than half an inch a day, but it's enough to get things growing again. So, yeah, I mean, this is actually a great time up here in the Pacific Northwest to start putting in some cool weather crops. And you can actually, especially if you have a hoop house or a greenhouse, you can just about grow something almost year-round, especially if you're looking at winter crops, things that can overwinter like kale and so forth.
Right. And so not only do you talk about, and it's interesting on the cover of the book, it's got a variety of different organisms here. There's a flower, leaf, there's some tomatoes, there is the classic red cap mushroom, some other fungus, some little grasses, and
Yeah.
As I was looking back at this book a while back, it just reminded me about how there are so many other different ways you can connect spiritually with nature other than just through the methods that we've seen most often in books. And so what was your big motivation for writing this particular book? This came out a few years ago, back in 2014. So it's not a brand new mm-hmm. book, but it is a book that I still wanted to talk about because it is, again, it's a different concept mm-hmm. than most others are familiar to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it's been out a few years. It came out in 2014. And, you know, it's actually kind of funny. I was chuckling to myself as you were reading my bio, because that bio is about as old as the book is. I've written several things since then. And, you know, like a lot of people, my path to nature spirituality started with the animals. You know, it's easier for us to empathize with other animals, you know, humans being Homo sapiens, it's easier for us to empathize with other animals because we can kind of get an idea of how they live and what we can learn from them and things like that. And so it's tougher to sort of break out of that animal headspace and start considering plants and fungi and slime molds and, you know, other living beings as individuals rather than as background. In fact, I, you know, since Plant and Fungus Totems came out, I also, you know, the book that came out after that was Nature Spirituality from the Ground Up, and that actually goes into connecting with your entire bioregion, you know, the entirety of the ecosystems overlapping with each other that are around you. And so it's almost, it's not always a linear progression for people to go from animals to plants to nature as a whole, but we definitely do have a bias towards other animals, in spirituality and otherwise. You know, our spirituality reflects our cultural biases. And, there's actually a marvelous concept called plant blindness. And basically what it is that we have a tendency in you know, the Western world in particular, and especially in an increasingly urbanized population, we have a tendency to see the plants and fungi and so forth of the world as sort of a monolithic backdrop on which animals live their lives. So if you're driving down the road, you know, you just see, oh, look, there's some trees. And maybe look over there and see, oh, there's a field. And I'm a naturalist. I'm a naturalist pagan. I no longer use the neo-shaman word. I use the term naturalist pagan. And so as I'm heading down the road or walking through a place, I'm actually seeing individual species and individual organisms. So it's a very different and expanded way of seeing the world compared to just saying, well, you know, I see some deer, those are really cool, and they're over by the trees. Or, you know, I'm hiking, it's like, gosh, I'm just not seeing anything because, you know, you're not seeing animals. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I think it is something that people have to be trained to do even within various pagan practices, because people that will otherwise say that they have a connection to nature may not be looking at and focusing on individual plants, or let's say if you go into a forested area, they might just be looking at the various trees and not paying attention to individual trees, individual species of trees. I mean, there are plenty of people I know, there are plenty of pagans I know that are not very familiar with even the basic major species of trees and other plants that live in their particular area.
That could not even go out and identify, like, you know, five different species of trees in your neighborhood. You know, that's still kind of strange to us that there are those who are pagans who are earth-based that don't, they can't do that.
Yeah, and what I've seen a lot in my personal experience is people concentrating more on herbs and plants, culinary and medicinal herbs, and not focusing a whole heck of a lot on what grows that is naturally occurring in your own backyard, in your own ecosystem, or the biome in which you live. And here in the United States, you can go from one coast to the other and from north to south and encounter many different biomes, nearly all, except for the polar biome, unless you're going to go up to the Arctic Circle. In the lower 48, every biome is represented, even the tropical biome, which is in Hawaii. So people just aren't that familiar with. And one of the things that also that I was intrigued by was the way you describe these different models of, I mean, it sounds very, it sounds very ecology-oriented. This is also why I like the book. It has a very strong ecology bit to it, and it's not as, it is moderately woo, but it's not
woo-woo.
Super woo.
Yeah,
it's not woo-woo. It's eco-woo, which I like. So what are these different models that you speak of in the book? There are three models that you talk about.
Okay, so those actually stem from the previous book, New Paths to Animal Totems, which incidentally went out of print, and I literally just re-released today as New Paths to Animal Spirits. It's the same basic book, but I changed the language a little bit, and that's actually something I'm self-publishing now. What I did there was New Paths to Animal Totems was my first book with Llewellyn, and what I did was I took the practices that I had been doing for well over a decade at that point. This was back in 2012 when it came out, and I basically broke them out into three different models. You have the bioregional model, which is working with totems or spirits of the land around you. So if you know me here living in the Pacific Northwest, I'm working with, you know, beings like Sitka spruce and black-tailed deer and, something really off the wall like Thallos liverwort. And so it's a way to connect to the land through the beings who live there. Then there's the correspondences model, which, you know, correspondences are things, you know, groupings of symbols like the directions or the seasons or the tarot or astrology, you know, any of a number of astrology systems, et cetera. And you work within those symbols and you find animals or plants or et cetera that, you know, that ally themselves with that energy so that you can, you know, kind of create a structure for learning more about the, again, the animals, the plants, et cetera. It gives you a good starting point. And then finally, the last one you have is the archetypal model. And, you know, archetypes, of course, you know, come from Carl Jung and then were later popularized by Joseph Campbell, particularly within the pagan community, et cetera. And an archetype is sort of an overarching being that embodies all of the qualities of its archetype. So, for example, in classic Jungian psychology, you have the shadow, which embodies, you know, sort of the hidden and sometimes the scary. You have, you know, the archetype of the hero who embodies, you know, what is brave and the part of us that meets challenges. It's internal stuff. And so the archetypal approach to totemism or spirit work works with the archetypal versions of nature spirits. So, for example, when I say I work with Sitka spruce, I'm not just working with an individual Sitka spruce spirit. I'm working with the archetypal being who kind of looks over and embodies every single Sitka spruce tree that has ever been and every story ever told about this tree and every bit of lore that we have about working with this tree physically and otherwise. And so I originally used those models to explain my practice, to break my practice down for new paths to animal totems. And so I did the same for plant and fungus totems because I wanted, again, to invite people to expand their experience side of the animal realm.
Okay. And you also talk about creating a system of correspondence. And one of the things that popped up in my head as I was reading through this, especially as it relates to the bioregional model, is what if somebody really does not have much of a clue but have seen particular plants, trees, shrubs, flowers? There's one that I've seen I'm going to have to look up that I'm very intrigued by that's been, it's, I think it still is growing in the backyard, and it puts out these,
purple.
No, not no. The purple. That's the,
yeah,
that was our,
oh, yeah.
Experimental mistake. Years ago, we brought home some wild violets from my dad's backyard,
mm-hmm.
put them in only one or two places in the front yard, and
they spread,
and they hop and skip and jump, and in late March and into probably at least mid-April, they bloom here in Northern Virginia. And so they're all over the backyard. And that's not the one I was talking about. That would be intriguing to look at. But there's this little flowering plant. It grows low to the ground. It's got one central stalk with a little tiny star-shaped flower. The leaves are dark green. I've seen it before growing in the forest around here in Northern Virginia. But I don't know what the heck it is, but I'm intrigued by it. And so this has led me to try to start looking for it. And so for people who don't have much of an idea, I mean, they might be able to tell, obviously, hopefully, they can tell the difference between a pine tree and an oak tree, but probably not
mm-hmm.
know the names of the different oak trees, because there's a bunch of them growing here on the East Coast, and it really depends on where it is as to what kind of oak tree you might encounter. Just using that as an example, but one place I think people can start is by going online and looking at their state's environmental resources page to look at common trees or common plants and
mm-hmm.
plants native to the area. And that's probably a way that people can do that to start trying to connect, or at least get information. Where do you suggest people start this particular journey? Because I think it is a kind of journey to start exploring working with plants. And we'll talk about fungus in a minute, because they are their own thing. They are neither plant nor animal. They are their own kingdom. Where would you suggest people start that have a vague notion of some native plants but really don't have a lot of background?
Well, my sort of my secret weapon when doing nature identification is a wonderful phone app, and you can do it for either iPhone or for Android, and it's called iNaturalist. You know, I is an iPhone, but again, it's for all of them, you know, all smartphones, and it's called iNaturalist. If you don't have a smartphone, you can also use it on their website as well. And it's this great thing where you take a picture. Let's say you go out in your backyard and you see that little plant that you don't know the name of. And so you take a picture of it with your phone and you upload the picture to iNaturalist. Now, what used to be is you would put in, you know, you still put in the location and the day you found it, things like that. But you also can put in the name of the plant. And if you don't know what it is, you just put in whatever you know about it. Even if it's just, it's a plant, you know, kingdom plantae. Or maybe you know, because it says flowers, that it's an angiosperm.
Right.
And so you put in Magnoliophyta. And so previously, the what would happen is you would leave that there, and then there are a whole bunch of scientists and naturalists and other people who just for fun like to go on there and tell people what they found. You know, they do identifications. Sometimes they'll correct the wrong identification. Sometimes they get into arguments with people about, you know, who's right, things like that. And so that, you know, for several years, basically built up this great database of identifications. Well, what iNaturalist did last year was add a feature where, based on your geographic location and how closely your photo resembles similar photos from your area, they actually give you several suggestions of what that plant or fungus or whatever might be. And I found personally that 9 times out of 10, the first one or two suggestions are actually what they, you know, are what it actually is. Now, I do go back and I go online and I go into my various field guides that I have to double check that it's a correct thing. But, yeah, that is probably my favorite starting point for people to start doing case. The thing is, a lot of the plants, especially if you're not in a strictly rural area, a lot of the plants in your yard are not going to be native, whether they were planted by you or not. You know, growing up in the rural Midwest, in something of a suburb, you know, almost every plant within my yard was non-native. You know, I remember growing up with dandelions and chicory and a couple different varieties of sorrel and, of course, grass, you know, lawns are made of grass. And so none of those were native. You know, I actually had to, when I go back to visit my family now, I actually go back and find more plants that, you know, I didn't know were native than I did when I was a kid, because now I know what I'm looking for, and I have the opportunity to get out of that little suburban area and explore some of the more rural areas that still have remnants of their native flora and fauna and fungi.
That is a good point, and that leads to the question of just because it's not native, does it have value as a plant that you want to try to connect with?
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good question. You know, it depends on, you know, for a lot of people, their goal in working with the plants is what they can get out of them. You know, herbalism is basically centered on what medicinal properties can I get out of this plant so that it serves me. Now, you do get some people who work with the spirits of those plants and they want to have, you know, more of a relationship. But, you know, it still kind of comes down to, okay, this plant has this chemical property which has this effect on the human body. And so, you know, it's a very much a one-way relationship. And so a lot of stuff you find in herbs, in herbalism in the United States is non-native species. You know, when Europeans came over to the United States and Canada, you know, what's now the United States and Canada and so forth, they brought with them plants that they knew would be edible, but also plants that they knew would be medicinal. And so that's why a lot of what we consider weeds now are going to be plants that actually have some medicinal value. And so from that perspective, they do have value to human beings because they have those purposes. Now, if you look at them from an ecological perspective, where you have plants that were uprooted from their native land and dropped into a completely different ecosystem half a world away, ecologically, those plants don't have much value because what they're doing is they're taking up space and resources that native plants need. And when you consider that almost every place in the world, including some of those rural areas, you know, remote, have been affected by human activity, when you consider that, and you consider that the biggest cause of species extinction, any kind of species, is habitat loss, then from an ecological perspective, the goal is basically to create as much space for native plants and other native species so that the ecosystems here aren't completely falling apart, because the beings that evolved together for thousands of years are suddenly having to compete with other species, including humans.
Right. So, and there are a number that come to mind, and there are herbs that we work with all the time, and we certainly cook with them, and have some sort of connection with them, like rosemary, lavender, thyme, sage, even mugwort. Mugwort's European.
Mm-hmm.
Artemisia vulgaris. I don't even know exactly what part of Europe it originated. But all the other plants that I just mentioned, they're all European plants that were brought here a long time ago. And probably largely altered from what they originally looked like and how they grew because of how much they've been hybridized and altered themselves. So, by the way, that iNaturalist is quite... We were just
looking at the what's been seen in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Different plants and animals and things that have been spotted and identified in just around where we live.
And
there's stuff I didn't know about.
Well, that lichen that you just pulled up there, we see it all over the place on trees.
Yeah.
And for those who are not quite aware, lichen are it's not a single organism. It is at least two, sometimes three or four organisms, or it's a symbiotic relationship mm-hmm. between either an algae or cyanobacteria. It's the photosynthetic part. And one or more species of fungi. And what we see on the level of the naked eye is something that has a variety of different sort of frilly appearances, especially the stuff that grows on trees. But you'd have to go down to the microscopic level to see where they separate.
Yeah.
And you, somewhere in here, you do mention lichen. How does one go about connecting with something like that? Because it's not one organism. It's actually multiple organisms.
I mean, that really kind of depends on your approach and your relationship with that particular organism. You know, you don't find a lot of the fungi and algae and you know, individual species that have come together through, you know, being part of a lichen, they're not found in nature on their own, generally speaking. You know, they're only found in the composite of the lichen. And so they spent so much time working together that, you know, trying to work with them individually would be like trying to, you know, go into an individual plant cell and working with the chloroplast, which, you know, many, many, many millions of years ago, you know, was an independent prokaryotic being. You know, there was actually a species of being that, you know, evolved to become the chloroplasts in plant cells because it got engulfed, but for whatever reason didn't get eaten. And then when that, you know, predatory cell divided, it basically divided the chloroplast with it. The, you know, what would be the chloroplast. So there's
yeah,
a certain level of... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, funny you should mention that because it's something that is discussed pretty regularly when we talk about in the biology classes that I've taught before about the origin of chloroplasts. So, I mean, that's actually a really good point that you can't really talk about plants. You can't really separate out the chloroplast from the rest of the plant, even though it was an ancient photosynthetic protobacteria a billion or couple billion years ago. So
mm-hmm.
then I guess the way you would approach it is as a whole organism, if you're going to mm-hmm. try to work with lichen.
Yeah, generally speaking, that's what I do. On very rare occasion, I will have individual species from that sort of composite being pop up. But for the most part, they like to work as a collective, in my personal experience. Your mileage may vary, of course.
So then this leads me to the next part of this. And again, using the animal spirit guide, animal totem model that many of us have read about, there are characteristics and attributes, and it can vary with the blowing of the wind from one author to the next as to what those characteristics are for that particular animal. And it can even be different between... related species. I've read that there are differences between attributes of the regular jaguar, which is the yellow background, not yellow, it's more tan, and with the black spots, and the melanistic jaguar, which has the very dark brown colored fur with the black spots. And that's, I've read, a couple of different authors kind of describe it differently. So, how does one go about assigning attributes? And I guess the larger question is, where do you find this kind of guidance, or how do you go about setting up meditations or journeys or whatever to find out what those attributes are?
Well, I mean, how do you find the attributes, so to speak, of the people around you? If you read my work at all, you know that I am not a fan of totem or spirit dictionaries. I don't like lists of, well, this animal means this, this plant means that, this fungus means this, blah, 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 blah. I don't like those because you have to have a relationship with that being to know exactly what they're going to teach you. It's one of the metaphors I use is that, it would be as though you were going to go on, you got invited on a date with somebody you never met, and, before the date, you went ahead and you went and talked to all those people that know them, their friends and family and coworkers, and asked, oh, hey, who's this person? What are they like? What are they like doing? And, blah, 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 blah. And then you never actually end up going on a date. You just say, oh, I know everything I know about this person by what these other people have said. And not only is that kind of creepy to go and, stalk somebody before you've even met them, but it also means that you're not getting to know them individually. And so for working with a spirit or a totem, you need to go and make that relationship yourself rather than just going to the nearest dictionary and saying, oh, well, oak tree is strength, and so I'm just going to go with that and call on oak tree whenever I need strength. And that's not giving you the opportunity to learn more about that particular being on its own terms and whatever it may help you with, if anything. Not every spirit is going to want to work with every single practitioner.
Right. So is it helpful to read information about that plant, like where it grows, what its growing season is like, those kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. Knowing the life history, the natural history of a particular species is absolutely crucial, because that is where we draw the lore from. It's not just something we picked out of the air. All that folklore and so forth surrounding certain plants or animals or whatever came from people observing them. Now, sometimes those observations are a little off pertaining to animals, people saying, well, if you wear, example, a dead bat around your neck, it'll prevent some disease or something. So, observations are not always accurate scientifically, but good examples from the animal world, in some indigenous cultures, bears are associated with healing. And, if you look at a bear's, behavior, they're going and rooting around for plants and roots and other things, many of which have medicinal properties. And also, if you look at a bear's skeleton, if you took off the paws and the skull, it would actually look very close to being human. And so that's part of why so many cultures worldwide have had such a strong relationship to bear, because of that, perceived connection. And so we are informed by the world around us. Now, what happened, of course, is that most modern pagans live that close to nature. If they do, it's often in an urban or a suburban setting where nature has been deeply altered. And we're coming at it from a very human-centric perspective, whereas, you know, a lot of indigenous and older pagan traditions came from people who lived with the land and still live with the land every single day, and filter that through their direct experiences with nature. And so part of how we reclaim that is by breaking out of this whole, you know, fast food idea of, oh, all I have to do is pick up this book and it will tell me all the secrets to working with these beings, and instead cultivate those individual relationships. Now, obviously, you're not always going to get to work with the physical being. You know, my primary totem, as my name suggests, is Gray Wolf, and has been since I was very, very young. I still yet to see one in the wild, because I've never lived in a place that had them in the wild. I've seen them in captivity, but I've never actually gotten to see one in the wild. And I may never get to if I don't, you know, depending on what my travel situation's like when all this clears up. But, you know, I can still study the natural history through the writings of others and through documentaries and things like that. And that gives me something to go on when I then go to talk to a given spirit or totem, knowing what it is that they're about. And after I have that initial conversation, like if I have a particular spirit say, hey, I want to work with you, just out of the blue, we'll have a conversation about what they want to work with, but then I'll go and I'll read up about them and find out what they have, you know, who they're about and what they like to do and so forth.
Right. It's like there's that disconnect that you run into just among modern people anyway, where, you know, you need to know where things are coming from and what they are. You know, I see articles about people who don't realize, you know, well, where do hamburgers come from? Oh, they come from the store. No, they come from a cow. You know, they come from this. This is the animal this is coming from. But they don't connect. It's hard for them to connect that what they're seeing at the grocery store, what it comes from, because they're so, you know, it's especially in the urban areas and stuff where you don't get a chance. Now, I mean, I was lucky enough to spend time on a farm. I got to be up close to cattle and pigs and chickens and horses and all this stuff, and I saw, you know, where food came from. I don't know if you want to get that far and say I could smell where it came from, but I, you know, that kind of thing where you know it, but people don't, and you need to kind of learn that. It's hard to learn about an animal or a plant or fungi or anything if you don't actually get to see it in the realm that it exists, you know, and
mm-hmm.
observe
right.
its behavior in the realm that it exists and that kind of stuff and see how it interacts with the other things in the realm that it exists. And that's unfortunate, you know, that we live in that kind of world. But I think, you know, it is a challenge for folks to be able to get out and like learn more about than what they just read in a book, you know,
right.
About something you know, and there's plenty of like, well, you got like National Geographic and all these programs on television. BBC has all kinds of natural, you know, nature related programs and earth related programming and stuff where you can actually see and observe, see at least through somebody else's eyes, how things behave and how they interact and how they coexist among the other things where they are. There's at least that.
Right. And so, and we're already at like 8:49, so
uh-huh.
I know.
Let's go another hour.
So what are some ways what are some places, for people to start cultivating these relationships?
A lot of it is just starting where you are physically. You know, look at the plants and the fungi and so forth that are, you know, closest to you. You know, whether you literally have a backyard or whether you know, you need to go a little ways to get to a park. And even, you know, if you practice herbalism, look at the herbs that you work with. You know, your house plants. House plants are another valid thing to start with. And so look at those species and learn about them and do meditation with the totem or the overarching spirit to learn more about, you know, that relationship on a spiritual level. And I say, I really want to emphasize that it's a relationship because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of times our spiritual work is very us-centered. What can I get out of this? What can I learn from this? How can I empower myself for this, et cetera? And it really is a two-way street. You know, my practice these days is largely based on my service to nature. You know, I'm not getting a lot out of it other than experiential, because what I'm doing is trying to do my best to listen to the beings of the land and ask them what I can do to give back to them, to try and right a little bit of the balance that has been so knocked off kilter for centuries now. And so just start with any single point and see where it leads you. You know, start by picking maybe one species in particular that really that you feel really attracted to, or that maybe has contacted you, and start meditating with them to see what they have to say, and then learn more about their natural history, and then start learning about some of the other beings that maybe rely on them or have a relationship with them and that share the same ecosystem as them, and go from there. You know, find any point that works and then just expand outward from there at your own pace.
And this particular book does have a plant and fungus totem guided meditation that what you can do is you can do one of a couple ways. You can have somebody read the guided meditation to you. But now we have this thing called technology.
Yeah.
And we can record our voices. And I know people are, some people are creeped out by it.
I remember back in the day when that meant sitting in front of a tape cassette recorder and recording your voice into the cassette recorder and then playing it back from a cassette tape. I can remember, you know, but, it, you know, we're back then. Yeah, but now you got, like, stuff you can do on your phone. You record it on your phone and then play it back.
Yeah, and you can play, and this is a good example of one. I like this one. And because of how you have people go through to in the meditation, and you're going through mycelium, and I know that's a complicated technical term. Mycelium is a type of filamentous fungi, and if you've ever walked in the woods, you may have even seen remnants of it, maybe from time to time, but it's usually almost exclusively under the ground because it connects to roots, and it extends the space beyond how far the roots grow, and they have this, because we talk about it in class.
Yeah.
I've talked about it in school because it's cool. School is cool. Mycelium is cool because of the benefit that they give to the roots, and the fungus gets something out of it too, so it's a win-win.
Uh-huh.
So whenever in nature, whenever you see a win-win and symbiosis, it's always a cool thing to see. But you have people going underground and connecting with roots and then moving on past that. So after a few tons of people doing that and listening to it, it doesn't take very long for people to get into a type of meditative state.
Yeah.
Where they are, they might have to start off with a few words and then they get into that visualization. Doing things first, like some deep breathing. And there are a whole bunch of different things by different authors that also help people to get down into a meditative state. You can visualize counting down from 10 to 1 and just a variety of other things. But once you are in that meditative state, then you just let the visualization guide you. And it's worth noting that it can be images, but it can also, if you're talking plants, sometimes it can be smells too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because I mean, smells. I mean, that triggers. That's a deeper trigger for memories and associations and things. Anyway, I mean, it's been shown in the studies and stuff that that's one of the biggest ways we associate things is with smell. You know, you smell something and it associates. It brings an association to your mind that is much stronger and much faster than any other sensory intake.
Right.
A lot of times.
And again, that's pretty much any, you know, use the starting point that works for you. I keep going back to that. You know, there's no single right way to do this. And, you know, what make it your own. Now, these are your relationships. I can't tell you. You know, it's why when people say, oh, what does this plant mean? Or what? I don't know. I mean, I know what they mean to me. I don't know what they mean to you, you know.
And that's important take-home message.
Yeah.
Because what it means to you is going to be based on whatever relationship you cultivate with that being, with that plant, or with that fungi, and it's also going to be based, of course, on your particular life experiences as well, because the way you conceptualize things will not be the same as somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's you know, that's why also, like, with the guided meditation that I offer, it's not, you know, oh, you go in here and I'm going to tell you exactly what that being says. No, it's basically a framework for you to get into a meditative perspective and then be able to have that conversation without it being scripted. So you can, so it's open. You're open to whatever beings show up, and you're open to whatever they have to say to you.
Yep.
Definitely. Now you mentioned that after this book, there are some other books of yours that have come out. Can you repeat those again?
Yeah, so in addition to the ones that were mentioned in the bio, you know, this plant and fungus totems, and then after that was Nature Spirituality from the Ground Up. That's the most recent one that I had from Llewellyn, and that came out, I believe, in 2016. And that's a really good one if you want to work with nature as a whole, if you want to work with the bioregions that you live in, as well as the animals and the plants and the fungi and all the other living beings that are there. And then on the self-publishing end, in 2017, I came out with The Tarot of Bones, which is a tarot deck and book, with bones as the primary symbolism. And, you know, not so much on the pagan end, but, you know, of interest to some people. Last year, I came out with Vulture Culture 101, which is a book actually on the sort of fandom or, you know, fancy around collecting bones and hides and other natural history specimens. And that was a lot of fun. And like I said, today I just re-released one of my old out-of-print books as New Paths to Animal Spirits. And that's a really great book if you are new to animal spirits or animal totems. It's got some great framework for getting started. If you're more experienced, it's a great way to pick up some ideas to incorporate into your practice. So that's what I've got going on right now. I have a few more books that are about to go out of print that I'm going to bring it back into print. It's self-published. And the newest book I just announced yesterday on my blog is called Coyote's Journey, Deeper Work with the Major Arcana. and it's based loosely on my Tarot of Bones Major Arcana, and it's basically a pathworking and personal, you know, internal work sort of thing, where you know, you're learning from the animals that I associate with each of the major arcana, you know, going into more depth on some of the things that they have to, you know, within the traditional tarot symbolism, but again, also making it your own, you know, finding
right.
your own way to connect to that energy.
And I do have to give a plug to the Tarot of Bones. It is a really neat, interesting thing that you developed, and I've never seen anything remotely like it before. And for people who are not quite aware, I am going to list in just a second where all you can find Lupa's books and other items, because you're an artist too, and you created this entire tarot deck using bones and natural things, and you created a card, basically, and then you took a picture of that, and you have it for the entire deck of
mm-hmm.
what would be the major and minor arcana. And I just think it's a really cool, interesting, very different way of working with tarot that way. So I'll have to go back and look at your blog again, because I look at it when I have time to, but not all the time. So now I've got to go back and look at that. And definitely there are a variety of ways. You have a blog. You are on Facebook. Your website is thegreenwolf.com, which also has links to your Etsy store, where you can also buy. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, basically, if you start at thegreenwolf.com, that's going to be the hub for pretty much everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in my artwork, you go to the artwork link, and it'll give you links to my Etsy and my store Envy and all that. If you go to the books, it gives you information on buying the books, readings, my blog, et cetera. So, yeah, that's kind of the starting point for all things Lupa, is thegreenwolf.com. Not Green Wolf, but The Green Wolf.
Right. The Green Wolf, all one word, thegreenwolf.com. And again, Lupa Green Wolf is on Facebook, and you have your community Facebook page. I guess that's what you call it for authors and whatnot. So Lupa is definitely findable, and I highly recommend you check out her stuff and buy some books. You have a lot of cool artwork. We have some of it at home. And David had to step away. In fact, David has a birthday coming up. So I've got to go back to the store, because there was a couple of things I was looking at in particular that I'm probably going to get for him. But I can say that now since he's not in the room. So anyway, yeah, David's birthday coming up. So, and as an artist, as somebody who is in business for themselves, definitely, if you are able to do it, support your artists. You mentioned something, one of the things that you were going to be going to, you weren't able to go to because of the virus and protocols of being close to other people. That has altered everything, and social distancing protocols. Hopefully, there will be some other things that once this abates, you will be able to do some things
mm-hmm.
as well. So
yeah.
Just keep us posted, and definitely, again, if you are one of the lucky people in the U.S. that still has a job, and there are many people that are, and there's any way that you can support your artists, definitely do so.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's been, as a self-employed person, it's been really rough financially, to be quite honest, because most of my income has just evaporated in the last month. So I always appreciate when people give my art and books a home, but I appreciate it a little extra these days. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that.
Definitely. And on Circle Talk, there will be some artists that will be interviewed in coming months, as well as on Mondays is Laura Gonzalez's show, and she also has artists as well. So I'd like to thank Lupa for showing up and talking about this very interesting topic, and I'd like to thank everybody else who listens to all of our shows every week. And I'd like to thank Circle Sanctuary for providing me and David and Laura and Deborah Rose with the opportunity to come and talk to people every week from all across the globe. And because it is springtime, let's see. I think I'm going to close off with the Elemental Chant by Spiral Rhythm. Thank you and many blessings.
Earth, my body, water, my blood, air, my breath, and fire, my spirit.
And thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.